The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Enjoy ultra-fast speeds up to 10 times faster than Sky's standard broadband.
Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast with Oliver Callan here in All Week for Ryan. And this is a compilation of our best bits from the last 5 days, all in the one merry place. And so this week, counselling psychologist Niamh Delmar talked to us about the impact the pandemic has had on her clients and how people are coping with the reopening of society now. Siobhan MacDonald told me about her new book, The Bride Collector, which follows a serial killer targeting brides-to-be in a Kerry tourist town. Explorer and geographer Bradley Garrett, he spoke to us about the world of preppers and bunkers and their plans on how to survive the coming apocalypse in whatever form it takes. Stephen Larmer from Larmer's Butchers in Monaghan told us about the inspiration behind their latest culinary curiosity or abomination, depending on your perspective, the Kinder Bueno sausage, or Kinder Bueno as he was calling it. And Claire Cullen spoke to us about finding her way back to education despite the many obstacles in her path to study with Tangent at Trinity College in Dublin. So that's it. Thanks a million for listening to the podcast and we'll chat again soon. And welcome back. So how have psychologists coped during the pandemic? Our guest this morning is Niamh Delmar, who's a counselling psychologist. And obviously when everything came to a banging halt last March 2020, so did her counselling centre. Good morning to you, Niamh.
Good morning, Oliver. Thank you for having me on the show.
Are you in good form today?
Good form, yes. Doing okay.
Hopefully no downpours wherever you are in the world.
No, it's looking good so far in Greystones.
I'm glad. Beautiful Greystones. Yes.
Yeah.
They like bragging down there, don't they? We'll let them. But come here to me. Obviously, you know, we'll talk to you first about how your clients handle the crisis and so on. And by the way, I want to shout out to listeners, because if you have any questions about the how you're coping with the reopening of society, 51551 is the text number. Let's go back to last March, Niamh. Everybody was just, you know, anxious and nervous about going about our own business. But for those who were relying on counselling services, that was obviously a much worse upheaval for them.
Really tough. People's anxiety went through the roof. Their port of call that they usually had with mental health services and that were disrupted. So a lot of adjustments and a lot of uncertainty, which anxiety does not like. So a lot of stress added to that, with worlds kind of turned around, and also worlds shrunk as people went more and more into their own 5K area, or it was 2K at the beginning, and into their own heads as well, and with no usual supports and all their healthy distractions taken away.
And obviously, people who need help, they need in-person therapy, don't they? And
yes,
the
people I've found, in my experience, really did prefer to have in-person therapy. It's great to have tele-services and online services, but it doesn't suit everybody. You know, sometimes it's not a safe environment for somebody to be at home having therapy. And sometimes we can't provide great service, or we don't have the technological, requirements for it. And it was also new to all of us as well. You know, Zoom took a while to kick off, so we were just kind of trying to do what we could do to keep people okay.
You mentioned there where people don't feel safe at home. You're talking about, you know, abusive situations.
Yeah, it could be that, or it could be just not wanting to talk in their house, or they may not have, you know, a lot of space, you know. Facilities were very limited. Everybody suddenly was working at home. School was happening at home. So there may not have even been space or, you know, confidentiality for them to be observed.
What's happening to those people now? I mean, have they just sort of fallen by the wayside? Because there isn't really a solution, is there, in the meantime?
Yeah, well, I think that as much as we could, we kept things going. The psychiatrists kept things going. The psychologists and mental health services kept everything going. And those in psychiatric hospitals kept things going. But, yeah, it was a different way. And we just need more and more people to present for help. And then we need the services to provide that help for them too.
But fortunately, you were able to do some counselling sessions online. How did you find that, and how did your clients find it?
They didn't, you know, I found it difficult because obviously everybody here working from home, a child, online school, you know, all the other things that everybody else had to go through out there, we were going through it here as well, under the roof. So dogs barking, you know, all those distractions, not great technology services, not great broadband here. So as soon as I could, I went back in because that was the demand and people really wanted it as well.
That was great. How soon did you get back into your practice?
It took a few months, and probably around June, July of last year, I started going back in with those most in need. So I got a screen and I did all the COVID protocols, did a lot of research, had our masks. Luckily, I have a centre with a very large room, windows, ventilation, and we were well over 3 metres apart from each other. But looking back now, it was all a little bit strange and different, but people took to it.
And it was better than online, wasn't it?
Better, much better, yes. For me it was, and for people that were coming into me, yes, absolutely.
I mean, people come into you, they obviously are, they've got anxiety, they've got mental health issues, is the reason they're there. I mean, was it quite difficult? You're coming into a room, there's a screen separating you, there's masks involved, and that distance. I mean, how big of an impact does it have in terms of how the treatment works and how your sessions would normally, and when I mean work, I mean the success they would normally have?
Yeah, good question. I mean, when people normally would come in, we want to make them feel really welcome. So not being able to shake their hands, they're seeing me with a mask on, they're kind of, you know, in behind a screen. So it was all a bit daunting at the beginning, but people really took to it. And I think when people are suffering or they have a lot of problems, they really are in that world, you know, so they just want to kind of explore that and they get carried away into that zone. And we kind of get transported out of the therapy room into another kind of dimension of therapy and treatment and looking at symptoms and trying to get people well.
What sort of problems are you seeing now?
The problems that I'm seeing now are more complicated and a lot more are requiring medication. I'm lucky here that I have a great link in with psychiatrists and GPs. People are suffering with anxiety, more panic attacks, and any pre-existing conditions have been exacerbated.
Wow.
The College of Psychiatrists would show an increase in referrals and relapses and also self-harm. More complicated, you know, presentations and just stress, life stress in general. You know, sometimes people were just putting on the brave face for home, for other people, caring for elderly people, worried about somebody that might be dying. And they're trying to put on that brave face and they needed somewhere just to come in and let it out and talk in a safe environment. Work as well, lots of changes, lots of people losing their businesses, jobs, and couples in crisis, and also the young people. You know, a lot of young people stuck at home, no college, no friends, no sports, no travel, no part-time jobs, no dating. You know, that they struggled too. So that's kind of what we were seeing.
It feels like a mountain of kind of hopeless problems, but then again, there is treatment and it does work.
Absolutely. And I think that's the rewarding part for us as health professionals, is seeing people wanting to love again or to live again and seeing them turning around or just feeling that bit better.
Yeah. You're in private practice, aren't you?
Yes,
so,
I am, yes.
Because just even before COVID even hit us, there were a lot of headlines about enormous waiting lists for the public services in terms of mental health. That must be just getting bigger and bigger.
That's getting bigger and bigger, and a lot of pressure on colleagues in, you know, the public mental health services as well. And I think there is a call for probably joining them a little bit more together, so those in private practice can, you know, link in and take a little bit of an overspill from those in the public sector. And obviously we have the community services as well too. So long waiting lists.
I should ask as well, the issues you're dealing with now and the anxieties you laid out there, are they very different to pre-COVID, or is it an exacerbation of what existed before?
Yeah, it is an exacerbation of what existed before. You know, like if people had issues with depression or anxiety, panic, you know, attacks, anyway, they seem to have been exacerbated. But also there are new presentations as well where somebody may not have had a history and then they're under extreme stress, which is a normal, you know, reaction to what has been going on, or if they've lost jobs or they've lost people. There's a lot of loss out there, a lot of grief as well, you know, and also things like intrusive thoughts, because people don't have their usual outlets, OCD as well. And then other people, you know, have turned more and more to alcohol and drugs as a way of coping.
Is that a huge problem you're seeing now, bigger than before?
Yeah, I don't work specifically with the addiction services, but yes, referrals to there, that is also increasing as well. And also, you know, anger as well. You know, we see that people coming in feeling that they have an issue with anger and that it's actually intruding in their world, and that can be a symptom of depression or stress or just complete overload.
What's the difference between the normal type of anxiety, if you can call it that, that we suffer to the type of anxiety that's presenting to you now?
Yes, great question, because it's like grief. You know, there's we expect people to have a certain level of depression when they're grieving. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with anxiety, you know, or stress even. If somebody's world is getting turned upside down, there's going to be a level where the person is feeling anxious, feeling stressed. I suppose the difference is when the person cannot function as well, or their relationships are suffering, or they're really feeling a change in their behaviours, and they're not able to function to a certain level.
You mentioned intrusive thoughts there. Can you just explain that a little bit for us?
Well, intrusive thoughts are a symptom of OCD or anxiety, and it's a very overwhelming situation for somebody, because they're literally stuck in their head and they have these thoughts that are bombarding them that aren't true, they aren't reality, but they're very frightening. You know, so they think they might have been, they could harm somebody, or, you know, that kind of content will come up for them, but they're bombarded day in, day out with those.
How does something like that get treated?
Well, I think, first of all, when people come in and they are brave enough to name them and talk about them, and then they realise what they are, their symptoms. They have no meaning, and they start to understand that. That's the first part of it. And then it's about getting healthy distractions going, getting the person out of their head more and more, which was hard in the pandemic, because normally what we'd be saying to people, you know, meet people, go out, distract yourself. So, you know, people weren't coming in concerned about COVID. It was the impact of the restrictions on their mental health that was exacerbating things as well.
Yeah. And one of the biggest effects of the restrictions was on funerals, wasn't it? And people who are grieving, regardless of how the person might have died.
Absolutely.
But what was your experience in terms of how those restrictions, not having that traditional funeral, how that affected people who were bereaved?
Very traumatic. And, you know, often people had family overseas, so they couldn't get to see them, they couldn't be with them. There is something comforting about being able to be with somebody or talk to somebody or be with them near the end. And then our traditional Irish funeral here is an example of support, people rallying around. I attended a few online myself, and I found it very sad. You know, people didn't have that support that they normally would have around them afterwards. And it can go on for days, as you know, in Ireland as well.
And one's mind and all that for people as well. I mean, it must intensify the grief when that was missing.
That's it. And people, you know, talking about how they would be used to people coming over to them afterwards and dropping food off. And I mean, those things, people did what they could as much as they could. But it was, you know, it was hard on people. They didn't have that gathering of people around them.
So if someone is listening out there and they've been grieving and they wouldn't have traditionally ever thought of going into therapy, and obviously grief is something that comes up and takes people by surprise, sometimes for the reluctant, the ones who are reluctant to seek counselling, what do you say to them?
That's it. So many people are, they either feel that they should be strong, they shouldn't need it, they should be able to cope, but it is that realisation that counselling is just really checking in with yourself, where you're at in life, and talking to somebody else that's outside your family. It's not anything that's going to be, you know, terrifying. It's having that conversation and looking and putting things into shape and then seeing what is going on. So I think people can fear it. They think sometimes everything is going to be looked into, or they're going to be analysed, or sometimes people have a different perception of what it actually is. But it's very hard for people, for many people, to actually stop and say, you know what, I need help. And sometimes just checking in with the GP first, having a quick chat.
Yes.
You know, and take it from there.
We've always said in this country, haven't we, that the GPs are like counsellors, aren't they?
Absolutely. You know, because that sometimes is the first port of call that a person will say, even accidentally, to a GP, you know, I haven't been feeling well, or I've been out of sorts, or I'm not sleeping. So that sometimes is the first port of call, or appetite is gone, things like that. And the GP picks it up then and can see, OK, there's a depression here, there's something else here. And then some people don't necessarily know how unwell they may be. You know, so we depend on other people sometimes to go to them and say, you know what, you might do with just having a chat with somebody or checking in with your GP.
Yeah. When it comes to your own mental health and how the psychologists, they often have to speak to somebody themselves, I'm sure. How have you coped in the last year and a bit?
Absolutely. I mean, throughout our training, during our masters, we have to be in therapy throughout the whole training as well. So we get an idea of what it's about. I found everything kind of stopped the first session. I found the first lockdown around that time was okay. I thought it was harder kind of after Christmas, and I think a lot of people did find that as well. But sea swimming, going out in nature, taking breaks, rest, all those little things would help, and also talking to colleagues and talking to friends, family, you know, just utilising all that as much as was possible. But, you know, up days, not great days, but that is the way it is for us. We sometimes forget as mental health professionals that we're not rocks. You know, all rocks can crumble. And a lot of times mental health professionals will be less likely to seek help because they feel they should cope, and people expect us to cope.
Yeah. And there have been surveys already, haven't there, on the impact of the pandemic.
That's right. On
people like yourselves.
Yes, and the College of Psychiatrists have done some research as well with regards to people presenting, and also that psychiatrists are, you know, indicating less well-being than they would normally do. And other studies in the UK would show, you know, anxieties and post-traumatic stress and things like that are featuring among healthcare workers and mental health professionals that have been working at the front line.
We would also probably see that psychologists are able to compartmentalise a little better because you're able to close the office and leave the problems there. But this obviously was all upended when you were doing sessions from home.
Yes, and for many that continued that way, you know, that was very difficult for them to try and create that boundary. You know, you could be doing a risk assessment with somebody, you know, you're talking about something that's very traumatic for a person. So being at home doing that, you know, the boundaries get very blurred.
Yeah. We're open for questions, by the way. 51551. Can you please ask your specialist, has she heard of depersonalisation, please? I have suffered very badly with it during lockdown.
Yeah. So, you know, this, it, again, could be something that is a symptom of something else. So it's to kind of really look at where this is coming from and how long has it been around, and is there anything else that has been happening, like depression, or is there any trauma, past trauma? Sometimes, you know, something like a global pandemic can tap into triggers and things that are maybe lying dormant. So it's really to look at what exactly that is a little bit further, and that would be a good idea to check in with a GP or with a mental health professional to just explore that a little bit further, where it's coming from.
What is depersonalization?
Well, it's when somebody isn't really feeling that they're there, you know, and the little bit of detachment, and that can happen to all of us at different times, but this can just really remove a person a bit too much from their everyday living.
Yeah. Would Niamh have any simple techniques to deal with low-level anxiety? I have worked from home for the past 18 months. I am due to return to work in September and it's starting to bother me.
Yeah. And, you know, the world has been on adrenaline in a way. You know, everybody has been on, whether we realise it or not, we've all been on. Our systems have been put on because we're in something that's a threat to us all. So, you know, when that person talks about anxiety, it's looking at what things help and what things exacerbate it. You know, could be a lot of stressors going on in that person's world. So we look at the biological, the social and the psychological. Things to calm down the system are, can be useful, like the Headspace app, getting into something that every day. Also getting a good, healthy lifestyle and looking at what the aggravating factors are.
I mean, you can't, when you're touching on the diet and exercise, really, isn't it? It's keeping your body in shape so that it can actually cope.
And again, that's okay for when things are a little bit mild. But when we hear things, you know, when I have people coming into me or they're referred from a psychiatrist, that's not enough. You know, I can't tell. It's like, say, if somebody has a really bad flu or a really bad throat infection with a fever, we can't tell them to go out and exercise.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
not the timing for that. But like to keep well and all those things are very important.
Yeah. For the low levels of anxiety that person
was described.
It's kind of a rumbling fear of the future, really, isn't it?
That's it. It's like an anticipatory anxiety that's there lurking around all the time.
Are you hearing from people who are really anxious about the whole reopening? Because while it's great news for industries, some people are just, because we had sort of trained our minds for lockdown, it's almost strange to think that we can just go about and go indoor dining and do other various things that we weren't used to for so long.
That's it. Some people will be bolting out there and others will be very wary. And we see that some people are still just feeling like they are almost still cocooning. You know, and they're anxious about it, or they're anxious about what is going to happen, or they've just kind of got a little bit institutionalized. You know, elderly people were cocooning for so long, it's very hard for them suddenly to just go out and do things again.
Yeah, because I notice that even walking along the footpaths, I see some older people sort of stand way back waiting for you to pass, because they're kind of institutionalized in a way, aren't they?
Exactly. It was terrifying for them, you know, and they were, you know, deemed as the high risk, and the media, everybody, you know, obviously scientists knew that, so they were hearing that all the time.
Mm. We have a tweet in here. I lost my dad to COVID at the height of the pandemic in January. My job offered a wellness and counselling service. I called them for help 3 weeks later. I was told they couldn't help me as it was too early. I haven't had the courage to phone them since.
Yeah, it's a really hard one. You know, some professionals feel there is a certain bit of time just to let a person kind of settle and work through the grief. But if that person feels they need help, I think people need to reach out or again check in with the GP or check in with them again to talk it through. It's like with any trauma or any traumatic experience, telling the story can help.
Yeah.
You know, just telling the story can help. And then finding ways and supports around you to kind of keep you afloat for a while. But it's just been so hard for people with their grief and their loss. And it's been such a lonely place for many of them.
As another texter, I lost my husband recently, but our son has never mentioned him since. Since he passed, no normal grieving process. Have you any suggestions?
And that's the thing. Everybody grieves in different ways. You know, psychologist Niamh Fitzpatrick has written an excellent book, which I always recommend to people, Tell Me the Truth About Loss. Yeah. And that's the thing to remember, is that there isn't any normal way to grieve. People grieve in different ways. I've seen some people will get angry and they'll be a bit snappy for a while. Other people will just go very much into their own little world and be cut off from everybody and just be depressed for a while. After grief, we all need a period of cocooning and going into our caves to try and recover and get our strength back again. So there's very different ways of doing that, but it's to try and find some language to talk to them about as time rolls out, and observe, chatting about the person, talking about some memories, having little rituals that, you know, might just acknowledge that person.
Mm, because, you know, nostalgia does work, doesn't it, as a treatment in many ways.
And that's it. Not everybody cries when they're grieving. You know, we expect this particular prescribed way to grieve, but it doesn't always happen like that. Some people just get completely immersed in work and get busy, you know, so there's no set prescriptive way to grieve.
And just one more. Any remedy for adrenal fatigue? My sister is suffering from exhaustion, having nursed through the pandemic and is off work. So this is going to be a common one with healthcare workers, isn't
it? Absolutely. And there has been a lot of people off work and they just burnt out, you know, and they just need that time out. And with burnout, it just doesn't happen overnight. It's going to take time. All the high adrenaline levels have to come out of the person's system. They need to kind of, you know, have some light, fun, lots of rest. You know, eating well, checking in with the GP if they feel it's going into something more, you know, like a depression or something. But really, the battery has to be recharged again. Anything that recharges it is good. Anything that's going to take away from it, it needs to be on hold. And that includes work.
Yeah. Well, Niamh Delmar, it's been a pleasure. And I hope you're able to recharge your own batteries, because you've got a lot of work ahead, unfortunately. You're a counselling psychologist, and thank God we have them. Because the treatment works. That's the hope, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It does work.
It does work. It's great to see people turning around.
If you can build the courage and take it on, you can conquer the demons. Niamh Delmar, thanks a million and good morning.
Thanks, after
yourself.
Oliver. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care. And welcome back. It's Oliver Callan here in for Ryan Turberty this week. Now, during the height of summer, you're looking for, you know, dark gothic crime story. Well, Siobhan McDonald's The Bride Collector is perfect for that. It's set in a Kerry tourist town where a serial killer is targeting brides-to-be. And you've got a local taxi driver and a reporter joining forces to track down. We won't give too much away because Siobhan McDonald is in studio. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Oliver. It's lovely to be here.
It's great. And you picked a great day, since we've been talking about brides nonstop pretty much for the first half an hour.
I know. It's so timely, isn't it?
Does it bring back memories of your own wedding, by the way, when you're...
Well, I don't think there were protests at our wedding. So. although we are celebrating a roundy wedding anniversary this
year.
So yes, I guess that's serendipitous in a way.
How roundy?
How roundy? Oh, God.
It's a rude question, is it?
Yes.
You don't have to answer.
It's quite roundy.
It's very round. Okay, yeah. Very good. Now, come here. I love The Bride Collector. I read it over the weekend. It's great fun. And you've created a town in it.
Yes.
It's kind of a fictional town. It's Kyle Beggan. Is that how you're
Kyle
pronouncing
Beggan,
it?
Kyle Beggan, yes.
So I was calling it Kyle Beggan, but that's a real place. So Kyle Beggan.
Yes.
And it's a really nice touristy spot and there's a murder thrown into the mix. So, I mean, it's in Kerry. You're clearly saying it's in Kerry. So is this kind of a composite of towns?
Well, I think, you know, they don't call Kerry the kingdom for nothing. I mean, it's a very kind of a majestic place,
yeah,
with, you know, huge mountain ranges, beautiful coastal scenery. And when people think of Kerry, it kind of conjures up ideas of, you know, beautiful towns like Kenmare and Killarney, mm-hmm, which are tourist towns. And I wanted my Kyle Beggan to be something of a mix of those kind of places that people associate with tourism, with conferences, with lots of Americans, European people coming on tour, and possibly people retiring there. You know, there's a genteel air to these places as well. Well, there certainly is in my Kyle Beggan.
Were you did you decide to make a sort of fictional town, maybe because if you had said it was Kenmare or Killarney, because they can be funny and Kerry about things like that. Was that one of the reasons why you decided not to just name a town?
Well, I thought I would have more scope if okay. I had a fictional town. And, you know, people in Kerry are very warm, very witty. And I had more scope when I was doing something that was fictional and I could add in things that, you know, wouldn't possibly be true to life.
Yeah. Now, it's great crack because when the bodies start to mount in this local small town in Ireland, which
yes.
is relying on its tourism.
Exactly.
You have the local newspaper editor and you have the town mayor, who's kind of like the mayor in Jaws in a way, who doesn't want the shark to ruin the big summer.
Well, you know, in a way, the reason that I picked somewhere like a tourist town, I mean, if you think back over what's happened over the last number of months with COVID, you can see the devastation that's been wreaked by something yeah. like a pandemic. And I don't know, maybe this was in the back of my mind when I was writing it. I was thinking, well, what would be the one thing that would be even more, well, possibly equally devastating to the tourist trade and certainly in a tourist town in Ireland? And I thought, well, how would a tourist town react if you raised the spectre of a serial killer? I mean, you'd have conferences cancelled, you'd have weddings cancelled, certainly in the circumstances in which these women were pitching up murdered.
And tell us those circumstances, those grisly circumstances.
Well, they were quite sinister. On a cold January night in Kyle Beggan, a woman is murdered and she's laid out in her wedding dress on her bed. And then the following month, another woman is found and she too is laid out in a wedding dress on her
yeah.
bed. So you then are introduced to a taxi driver, Ellie Gillespie, who is collecting a number of women from a hen party. And one of those women is a bride-to-be. And you can imagine how she felt when she dropped this bride-to-be home and finds out the following day that this woman too has been murdered and laid out in a wedding dress
yeah.
on her bed. So that these kind of circumstances are highly unusual. And there seems to be some kind of a ritual element to what's going on. So you can imagine if something like that were to happen in, well, virtually any tourist town in Ireland. It's just that I picked somewhere that I write quite cinematically. And I imagined this town that was surrounded by big majestic hills and it's almost holding on to its secrets. And to answer your question in a long-winded way, you can imagine how the townspeople would react, how the Gardaí would react, how the
yeah.
mayor would react. You know, people are going to want an end to negative publicity because this is how they earn their living.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting you picked a taxi driver and a female taxi driver as well,
yes.
Which are obviously more common than they would have been quite some time ago.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting kind of perspective to be a taxi driver, and Ellie is... It becomes a kind of an amateur sleuth here, doesn't she?
She does. She is she kind of fancies herself as an armchair detective and she loves listening to real crime podcasts and likes to try and figure out, you know, who the killer is. And
yeah.
she thinks she has a knack for something like this. But if you think about taxi drivers, they get to see a lot of life that the rest of us wouldn't see. Mm-hmm. And they make for, I think, an ideal amateur sleuth in that they know a lot about what's going on. They might be taking people to hospital. They might be collecting them from hospital. They might be taking them to the airport on their holidays. They know what houses are empty. And they'll, you know, from time to time, they can be taking people to clandestine arrangements, people who are having affairs.
Yes.
And then often people talk to the taxi drivers as if nobody else is listening. And certainly if they've had, you know, a few drinks. And this lady, Ellie, this taxi driver, she almost feels like her taxi is a bit of a confession box on wheels. Mm. So she has a lot of knowledge that other people wouldn't have.
Do you have experiences with taxi drivers that sort of made you think, yeah, this will be a great perspective, a rich seam for you to write about?
Yeah. You know, sometimes I think characters seed themselves in your psyche early on, and sometimes a plot comes along. And you then think, oh, that character would be ideal in this plot. As was the first female taxi driver that we came across, my husband and I lived in an old-fashioned tenement flat in Edinburgh. And it was our first flat. And the lady in the flat above us, she was a very grand woman with the most amazing clothes. And she drove a black cab in Edinburgh. Yeah. And she had lots of stories. She was an interesting woman.
Right.
And I guess she stayed in my mind because we had no furniture in our first flat. Mm-hmm. We had two deck chairs that we borrowed. And she had this amazing sofa that she was chucking out. So she said, would you guys like to have it? So she always kind of stayed in my mind for that reason. And then I did have quite a bizarre experience with a taxi driver once in New York. I was on a course and I had missed the bus that we were supposed to get back to JFK. So I rang a local taxi and this guy pitches up and I thought, oh, this could be interesting, but I was up against the clock.
Yeah.
And the registration on the back of the car was NAMVET.
It was a NAMVET.
NAMVET. So anyhow, it was only when I got into the car that I realised this was like a throwback to the 80s, you know, cars that you would have seen in Ireland held together with twine.
Right.
Which we're all far too sophisticated for now. There's nothing like that now. And this guy, he asked me what I did for a living. And I said, well, I'm here on a course. It was a telecoms course. And I'm a technical writer. And he obviously just heard the writer part. And yeah. He said, you know, you see this bundle of papers here. He had The car was ramshackle. It was in rag order and he had a big bundle of papers on the passenger seat. And he said, I was out in Vietnam and a lot of my friends are stuck behind enemy lines in Laos. And this is all the documentation about them. And I've also been helping fight the drug war down in South America. I really would like if you would come and help me write my memoirs. And he started getting more and more insistent about this and saying, you know what, we should pull in off the highway. We go to a restaurant and we can go through all of this.
Oh, God.
And it took me all my powers of persuasion to convince him to get me to JFK. I think the fellow was probably suffering from PTSD and whatever.
Of course,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, I felt sorry for him, but I also felt
unsafe.
Not a very safe situation. Yeah. Yes.
Right. That was an interesting, salty connection. By the way, you said you were a technical writer, and that was one of the reasons I mentioned that taxi driver wasn't always the most popular female job. You were in engineering.
Yes, I did.
Before you became a writer.
Yes, I did electronic engineering. But really, I always wanted to get into writing. And with an engineering degree in tow, I figured out there was a job that you could do called technical writing. And I went to Scotland and I worked for a company called NCR. And they make the auto teller machines even to this day.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a way of, a little conduit into writing for me. And I really enjoyed that. I had some
writing about ATMs.
Well, no,
it's
not particularly. Well, you know what?
Collecting.
It wasn't even particularly writing about ATMs. It was that you were working with a lot of, I suppose, like-minded people who might have done degrees in English literature, who then ended up doing technical writing because, you know, it was quite lucrative, to be honest. And you were also working with a lot of graphic designers, and they were a very interesting bunch of people to work for, because a lot of them would have been working on contract. Yeah. And, you know, they might work 6 months on an oil rig, or they might be walking in South America and doing hill walking. They were, you know, they were kind of maverick type of people. Yeah. And I worked with them, and, you know, we did have very good fun in the office. So I enjoyed that. Great.
And you grew up in Limerick?
Well, I was born in Cork. I lived there until I was 8, and then we moved to Limerick.
That's that gets complicated around the Munster Championship time. So do you consider yourself a Corkonian, or are you Limerick?
Well, you know, now I'm a Limerick woman, but all my early memories of everything I did, you know, everybody remembers their first day at school and their the first cinema visit and their childhood friends. And so, you know, I have very fond memories of Cork.
Your formative years, yeah.
Yes,
up to
they
the
were.
Age of 8, yeah.
Yes.
So
yes.
You're like Charlie High. You're kind of Cork. You straddle a number of counties. It's very good. That could be useful. That could be useful. That's the only likeness to Charlie High, by the way. So I'm getting carried away. But you grew up, and what was your childhood home like in Limerick?
Well, the reason actually that we moved from Cork to Limerick, I suppose we had a bit of a different upbringing, in that I'm the eldest of 6 children, and the third person in our house to be born was my sister, and she suffered a lack of oxygen at birth. So, among other things, she has an intellectual disability. And one night, my mum and dad were watching The Late Late, and there were 2 guys on called Doman and Delcato. And they headed up an institute in Philadelphia called the Institute for the Achievement of Human Potential. Oh. And their idea was around the neuroplasticity of the brain. And their philosophy was that, OK, there were parts of your brain that might be damaged, not able to perform certain functions, but that other parts of your brain could be trained to take over those parts. So my mum and dad were quite intrigued with this idea. And my sister was, at the time, she was about 6. They took her over to Philadelphia to meet these people. They were very impressed with the programme. And they came back to Cork. We all then hightailed it up to Limerick, where we got a brand new house in a housing estate, and it was kitted out as a kind of a rehab centre for my sister. And we did this programme in the house, I would say, for something like 7 years. Wow. So our house was, you know, not really like anybody else's house. No. It was all kitted out with, we had a patterning table, we had a horizontal ladder, we had cutouts of hands and feet on the floor.
Yeah.
Because my sister would be on a patterning table with a person at the head, a person at one arm and leg, and similarly on the other side, and you would perform these movements as if you were creeping and crawling, and then she would go from there onto the floor to reinforce that pattern, because the Doman Delcato method suggested that if you hadn't gone through all these phases, to do so created these neural pathways. And, you know, it did. There were a few families in Ireland who did it at the time, and it did make a big difference to my sister, because in the beginning, she couldn't feel hot and heat and cold.
Wow.
Her speech was very poor. Her balance was very poor. And doing this programme, you know, it really helped her. But our house was very busy, because we had the neighbours in all the time helping us with it.
Yes.
And we had a lady in that would help mum. I mean, my mother would cook and look after 9 of us in the house. So, you know, it was a remarkable achievement on the part of my parents to even undertake to do this.
They devoted their lives really to care, in a way, didn't they?
Well, they devoted their lives to getting, to making my sister's quality of life as good as it possibly could be. So, and they did manage to do that. It was a big ask for them to do that, because their whole lives were, the programme would start at 8 o'clock in the morning and it might run through until 10 o'clock at night. Yeah. And we were all involved.
And were you old enough to understand what was going on?
Yes, yeah. I was. I think I was about 8 when we moved to Limerick. And, you know, that we had a good bunch of neighbours around us. And I mean, our house is a bit like Grand Central Station. All the neighbours would come in and help. And my mother would make them, having done these patterning sessions in the morning and the afternoon, she would make all the neighbours coffee. And it became a kind of a community effort, really. So we were very grateful to the neighbours as well for helping out.
And your mum worked outside the home as well. So she was extremely busy.
She was the sort of lady, she used to say, she's passed away now, but if something fell on the floor, she'd kind of say to herself, well, now that I'm down here, is there something else that I can do? You know, it was always trying to double up. Yeah. And she had amazing energy. She was just a beacon of energy. So she, as well as doing this program and looking after all of us, she taught speech and drama. She wow. was very much interested in the theatre and in drama. So towards the tail end of this programme that we did, she would have all the local children in and, you know, do elocution lessons, mime. She was a brilliant mime artist.
Right.
And she introduced a lot of children in Limerick to the Féile and Feshes. And she was always doing dramatic solos with us all and little plays and poetry readings. And she would write little bits and pieces of poetry herself. And of course, she was a brilliant reader. So she yeah. kind of got me into reading and then ultimately writing.
She sounds like an inspiring figure for you.
She was very much.
And it comes across in the book because you have great respect, a great mass for older people. Does that come? Are you thinking about your mum and some of the older?
My mother would never have thought of herself as an older person. My mother was forever, I mean, she's passed on now, but she was yeah. forever young in her own head. No, I did another large female influence in my life in, you know, reading and writing. And certainly when I was writing The Bride Collector, she came to mind a good few times was my granny.
Right.
My granny lived in Lismore and I would go and stay with her in the summers. Especially after she became widowed, and she would bring me to the local library. So I remember lots of my local visits to the library, and she lived in this big old house, and I would, you know, curl up on the couch and read all my books that I'd gotten from the library.
And she was a kind of a ghost storyteller.
Well, she was. Yes, she did. I don't know whether you should really tell small children ghost stories.
Okay. In Lismore, though, because it is quite a haunting, beautiful place, isn't it?
It is a haunting, beautiful yeah. place. Yes, she did tell me a story once of seeing a ghost down by the Blackwater. And she told me about two other ghosts that she had seen. But she kind of, you know, spoke about them in a very normal and natural way. It wasn't really a spooky way. I just, yeah. She was probably connected quite spiritually, I imagine. Yes.
So there was definitely something in there. This is
yes.
your second book within a year. So you were writing in lockdown, I take it.
I was writing in lockdown. And when you say it's my second book within a year, I think when I got the publication deal, I had most of Guilty written and I had the idea then for The Bride Collector. So, yes, I was writing in lockdown, which... was all very interesting when both my husband and I ended up getting COVID in the middle of lockdown.
Wow.
So,
how was that experience?
It was very, you know, I suppose it feels like a fog now looking back.
Right.
It was a very, very sobering experience. It kind of started out, I remember when we went to get our COVID test and we were in the drive-through on the Ballysimon Road in Limerick and we were kind of taking it lightly, as you do when you think there could be something bad in the offing. And we were thinking that we would take, you know, selfies of, you know, date night, mom and dad go on date night to send it off to our two boys. And then we thought, you know what? No, that could be, you know, inviting doom. So we didn't bother, but we had been kidding waiting for the test. Yeah. And then, of course, it was Friday, November the 13th, you know, again, superstition. Yeah. We found out that we were positive, but... I started to get better maybe 2 weeks into it.
Okay.
But my husband started to get worse.
Wow.
Even though he was saying, no, I'll be fine. You yeah. know, just leave me here on the sofa, I'll be fine. But anyhow, he did end up in hospital for a couple of weeks, and wow, that was not a very nice time.
Yeah, well, it's quite a roulette, isn't it? It seems that you're fine, he was suffering.
Yeah, you know, both seem to be making progress at the same pace, and we were checking in with one another. Although, you know, it is something that you do lose your perspective on reality a little bit.
Right.
And, you know, my sister would call up to the window and look in and wave and drop off parcels, and all the neighbours and my friends were absolutely terrific and brought some amazing meals. I remember that. That was the nice part. But you do lose your perspective a bit. And I think possibly I should have called for help sooner. But you just go into this kind of fog, and you're
well, you assume you're going to be okay, isn't it?
You assume you're going to be okay. But anyhow, look, they took fantastic care of him in UHL, and I'm extremely grateful for that. And we've come out of it well and good and unscathed. So
fully
we
recovered?
Feel very, yes, fully recovered. We feel very, 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 very grateful and very thankful for that.
Brilliant.
Yes. Yeah.
That's good news. Look, it's a great book. I was a bit sceptical going into it because I was thinking, oh, is this, maybe this isn't for me. You know, I was being a bit cynical going, oh, this is maybe for brides. But anyway.
Well, there are plenty of male characters in it as well. You know, we have a very interesting male character in
it. It's a fantastic plot. And particularly because it's small town Ireland, we feel like we know. We know the beats and what's going on in the town and what you can say. I really love, and I ended up going through it within a day and a half. And there are loads of twists, which I didn't guess because I've prided myself sometimes in a twisty book of getting it, but I could not have got this one. It was a bit
Thank
of a curveball at the end. So The Bride Collector, and it's out on Thursday.
Its publication day is on Thursday, but I believe that it's in a lot of the shops, and I'll be tootling off to some of the shops there this morning. I think it's in the booksellers already, but you know, the actual official publication day is Thursday.
Where are you going to today? Are you
I am going to a lot of the Easons in the centre of town.
Very good. Dublin.
Dubray, Hodges Figgis, the Gutter Bookshop. That's, you know, hopefully I'll manage to make it all, and the high heels will come off and the runners will go on.
Well, we wish you well, and we hope that people pick up The Bride Collector in their local bookshop as well,
absolutely,
wherever they may be. Siobhan McDonald, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me, Oliver.
Take care. Good luck. Welcome back. 51551 is our text number, ryan@rte.ie. Now, we go to the world of preppers. These are people who prepare for the end of the world by building bunkers and stockpiling supplies. And they felt very vindicated by the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic. So how big is this world of prepping for catastrophe? Well, my guest this morning is an explorer and a social and cultural geographer. His book, Bunker, Building for the End Times, is like a globe-trotting adventure, really, and takes a deep dive into fears and dread. Which are held by these so-called preppers and the fortresses they are building. Bradley Garrett, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're in good form?
Well, I survived. We're all surviving.
and that's a kind of a serious question as opposed to small talk, because when I read the introduction to the book, it makes me feel like I want to run into a bunker, because you're listing all of the things that have gone wrong in the past and all the things that could go wrong. And it almost feels like no way to live. So, you know, how do you keep your mood up while thinking about these things?
I spent 3 years living with these preppers around the world, and I have to admit it. There was a lot of doom and gloom. A lot of people, you know, speculating on potential disasters that could unfold. But there was also a lot of hope, because, of course, if you don't have faith that you're going to make it through a disaster, there's no point in preparing for it. I learned a lot spending time with these preppers about what we can build, how we can prepare, how we can create a kind of insurance policy to be able to make it through potential disasters. And of course, when I started working on the book in 2017, I had absolutely no idea that we were headed straight towards one.
And do these preppers feel a bit vindicated by the last year and a bit?
In some ways, they were better prepared than most people. I know a number of the prepper communities that I worked with were able to retreat to their bunkers in the first few weeks and months of the pandemic, which, you know, as everyone remembers, we didn't know how it lived on surfaces. We didn't know how it traveled necessarily. And so there was a lot of uncertainty. They were able to retreat to their communities, and we can talk about what those communities look like.
Yeah,
they're pretty exceptional. But once they were in there, they could create their own bubble. And people within those communities had complementary skills, so they could assist each other in staying inside their bubble as long as they needed to. They didn't need to go to grocery stores. You know, while the rest of us were panic shopping for water and toilet paper, they were safely waiting it out to see what was going to happen.
I want to take a little step back, just a small bit, to your own upbringing in California, which would have been a place that you would have craved safety after the experience you had in childhood. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I grew up in Southern California during the 90s, which was quite a dangerous time. There was a lot of crime. And I realized in hindsight that I actually had friends whose parents were what we call survivalists now, or what we called survivalists then. Now we call them preppers. But they were stockpiling supplies. They were building bug out bags, you know, a bag that you could take with you on the road at any moment.
Right.
And they were sort of practicing getting out of the city in case, you know, social tensions came to a boiling point. And so I had sort of experienced some of this culture without knowing it, really. And once I started researching the topic, I suddenly had the realization that I had been around preppers my entire life.
Because you obviously in your childhood, it would have been just normal to you. And when did it become clear to you that the kind of the danger you were growing up around wasn't normal?
Well, I guess when I moved to the UK in 2008 to do my PhD, and I remember having conversations with friends at pubs about, you know, getting beat up on the streets and having friends murdered and, you know, seeing the shock register in people's faces. They didn't, you know, that wasn't an experience that they had in their childhood. So, you know, I guess there was always probably some part of me that was seeking safe space, you know, or seeking to put in place some control over the parameters of my existence. And, you know, I guess that's part of the reason why I was able to identify with these preppers and what they were telling me.
Is that why you may have spent a couple of years writing this book, basically traveling bunker to bunker all around the world?
Yeah, I went to four continents and interviewed at least 100 people for this book. I visited some of the most extravagant private subterranean citadels in the world. It was, I guess initially I just thought it was kind of, you know, as a geographer, I thought it was a quirky, interesting topic about how people change space and control space and produce space. But the more time I spent with those preppers, the more I realized there were some practical lessons that were actually worth getting into the book to pass on to people. And that's, you know, that was the goal eventually.
Because we kind of associate the bunkers with the kind of Cold War period, the nuclear, you know, the nuclear fears of the 60s, and there was going to be a nuclear shelter. And that's what probably we might associate with them. I was very surprised at how many bunkers there are all around the world. Because America had a very specific way where the government was telling people, we're not going to build one for you, you're going to have to do it yourself.
Well, that also took place in Ireland. The government here, just after the Cuban Missile Crisis, constructed a bunker in the middle of the country that was...
Athlone.
Athlone, yeah, exactly. That was for government officials, essentially. But there were small-scale bunkers that were meant to maintain the communication network. The thing about the bunkers here is that a direct nuclear attack probably wasn't on the table for Ireland. So the concern here would have been nuclear fallout from a strike on London.
And how big is that bunker? It's still there in Athlone.
It's still there. Yeah, it's been decommissioned, and I think they've stripped out all of the infrastructure. I mean, at one point it still had the kitchens. There were RTE broadcasting facilities inside the bunker.
Well, they were planning to move the government in the event of a catastrophe to Athlone, which would become the new capital of Ireland, which they'd be delighted to hear.
That's right. Yeah,
and RTE would have to broadcast live from there, State of the Nation addresses or whatever by the Taoiseach and so on.
Yeah. Well, the
fairly advanced,
you know, radio broadcasting facilities sometimes feel like a bunker already. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, you'd love our bunker in Radio 1. And so that's in Ireland. That'd be a pretty small one compared to someone you've seen. I mean, Switzerland are pretty well prepared, aren't they?
Yeah, Switzerland, probably the most prepared country on earth. They've got underground hardened bunker space for 110% of the population. Which is very interesting. I guess they just maybe, you know, if they assume...
Which is over 8 million people.
Over 8 million people,
they can fit into their bunker.
Yeah. A lot of them are infrastructural spaces like the undersides of road bridges and things that they've just adapted so they can close off a door, and they've got nuclear, biological, and chemical air filtration. But yeah, they can house the entire population of the country and then some.
Wow. And anywhere else in Europe that has the, because I'm sure Britain has one.
Well, yes and no. There are probably bunkers that we don't know about.
Really?
There are some bunkers from the Cold War that have been decommissioned, and those details have been released. I opened the book with an exploration of what was the largest Cold War bunker that the UK built in underneath Wiltshire. It's called Burlington. Mm-hmm. An incredible facility with 60 miles of roads. Wow. Again, radio broadcasting facilities, kitchens, a reservoir where they can pull drinking water. And what was most interesting was a library that was still stocked, that had every book, map, diagram that you would need to reconstruct the UK in the event of an all-out nuclear Armageddon.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting is that we've moved on, as you mentioned, from that kind of Cold War scenario where we're thinking about a specific threat. And we've moved on from it being solely the realm of the government to make these preparations.
Yes.
And primarily what Bunker is about the thriving private market that is now emerging. And a lot of that is about reappropriating some of that Cold War architecture and trying to turn it into a commercial real estate enterprise. Mm. Which I think speaks volumes about the dread that everyone's feeling about our current situation.
Yeah, and it is quite an American phenomenon, this in particular, isn't it? Because you have this amazing statistic, I think it's from 2012, up to 40% of Americans think building a bomb shelter is a wiser investment than saving for a retirement, a peaceful retirement.
That's right, yeah. And currently, almost 13 million Americans are prepared to make it through 30 days without any sort of infrastructure, without grocery stores, food, water, electricity. That's an astounding statistic.
Yeah,
it was 13 million people. A lot of that stems from people's loss of faith in the government to be able to protect them in the event of a disaster, which was also reflected in the response of United States citizens to the COVID pandemic.
And you met some of these interesting characters. Tell us about the X Project.
Oh, the X Point, yeah.
The X Point, yeah. Sorry, yes.
Yeah. So I met a California real estate developer named Robert Vecino, and he was leasing these ex-government bunkers that were built during World War II, actually. It was a munitions storage depot, and the U.S. government built 575 concrete igloos that were spaced over an area about three quarters of the size of Manhattan, a huge area in the middle of South Dakota.
Which he says is the safest place.
And he says this is the safest place on Earth. So he calls it the X Point, and he says it's the point from which humanity is going to reemerge after the next great calamity. And he's been moving families into these bunkers. So there are about 40 families living in there now. And eventually he would like to fill all 575 of those bunkers with thousands of people. And I was able to spend about a month there over the course of a couple of years watching people move into these empty concrete shells and turn them into actually quite a beautiful little neighborhood.
Some of them are preparing them for when they might need them, but others are actually living there now.
Yeah, some people are living there full time. I think they're not supposed to be because it's leased government land.
But I found it quite sad because it's part of the gigantic paranoia that some of the preppers seem to suffer from. And they've obviously, you know, fallen foul or they've fallen into the arms of conspiracy theories, a lot of them. And some of the stuff, even the guy that you were speaking to who's selling these bunkers, you know, he spouted a whole lot of propagandist nonsense, didn't he?
He did, yeah. And in the book, I try to separate the preppers from who I call from the dread merchants. Vecino is one of these that I call the dread merchants. It's obviously in their interest to stoke people's fears, to get them to buy into the bunker spaces that they're selling. But a lot of the preppers that I met that were moving into these communities were quite reasonable, rational, normal people. They just they felt that, you know, if they had a bit of disposable income, it made more sense to them rather than buying, you know, a caravan or a boat or something, you know, that they would spend money on a bunker. that would be their holiday space, but would also double as an insurance policy in case things went terribly wrong.
And they do expect things to go terribly wrong. What does 72 hours to animal mean? This is a slogan the preppers use a lot.
72 hours to animal. Yeah, it's essentially the idea that if grocery stores closed, if food wasn't delivered, if the taps turned off, if the electricity stopped, it would take about 72 hours for everyone to just go completely feral. And, you know, we all had a taste of this over the past couple of years. It felt a little close, didn't it?
Yeah.
You know, if the grocery stores had shut their doors, that kind of would have, you know, we would have gone down a very bad path. And you can imagine that if the fatality rate from COVID was a bit higher, it would have taken a lot to get people to go into work to do those jobs.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen looting when things go like a natural disasters or worse in some cities. But it's always a minority, isn't it? It's always a small group.
It is, yeah. But I agree with the preppers in that it wouldn't take much for that to expand. And one of them told me that, you know, they have no desire to take from their neighbors or, you know, to create more friction in the world. But they did want to turn themselves into a bit of a hard target, you know. So if looting was taking place, they want people to go for the grocery store, not for their house.
You went to the wealthy, obviously the wealthy elite who are flying off into space and so on at the moment.
Yeah.
They are thinking of the super bunkers. That industry now exists for them, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. The most extravagant bunker that I visited was in Kansas. A real estate developer called Larry Hall purchased an Atlas F nuclear missile silo from the U.S. government. This was a decommissioned missile silo. It's about 60 meters deep, and he pumped water out of this missile silo. Obviously, the missile is no longer in it. He pumped water out of the silo, and he turned it into a subterranean condominium complex. I call it a geoscraper in the book, sort of the opposite of a skyscraper.
I thought it was an interesting term because you just literally picture a skyscraper that goes in the opposite direction.
Exactly. Yeah. So as you descend into the earth, you're moving through floors of people's condos. And he was selling half floor condos for $1.5 million and full floor condos for $3 million. And they sold out within months.
Wow.
He's got 57 people in there now with space. And there are also recreational facilities. He's got a shooting range, a swimming pool with a waterfall, a cinema, a bar. I'm not sure the bar is a great idea if everyone's locked in there for a long time. But he told me that those things are not luxuries, that if you're thinking about staying underground for a significant amount of time, the distraction is necessary to maintain social order within the bunker. And he was very clear about the fact that he was going to be the one who was going to maintain social order.
And how long would they be able to survive without having to surface again?
Five years.
5 years. That's incredible, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. So I began to think about a lot of the bunkers that I was seeing in terms of time rather than space. So when you construct the bunker, you're always thinking about how long you might need to stay down there.
Yeah.
Now, in the case of nuclear fallout, for instance, you'd be looking at 14 days. That's when the radiation levels will fall to, you know, a relatively safe point and you can emerge from the bunker. But, you know, with the pandemic, you know, feasibly, you could have stayed down there for 2 years and just avoided the entire situation.
But since and it took a while to figure out what COVID-19 and how it was going about the place. I mean, it was effectively dirty air. So the bunker isn't worth anything if you suddenly find an infected person among you and everyone's going to get infected eventually.
Well, and that's where the mechanisms of control come in, because the developer of the bunker would say in order to maintain its biological integrity, no one can enter or leave. And that's a decision. I mean, you know, who makes that decision, right?
Right, yeah. As you say, dread merchants is the way you put it. Donald Trump, he has his own private bunker down in Mar-a-Lago.
He does, yeah. My theory is that part of the reason he spent so much time at Mar-a-Lago during the, you know, the early days of his presidency, which were quite shaky, was because he wanted access to his private bunker. He didn't trust the bunker under the White House, and he didn't trust the officials around him to protect him. And so
or vegetables. He doesn't trust those either.
He doesn't. Yeah, exactly. But I think he spent somewhere in the realm of $100,000 fixing up the bunker under Mar-a-Lago, which was also a Cold War bunker.
And I didn't know this, but he actually made some very significant decisions while down in his private bunker as president.
He did, yeah. He ordered some airstrikes. He had he had significant meetings in that bunker, which, you know, can be seen as problematic. You know, that's his
paranoid man.
That's his private space.
A lot of this, and the people you meet, the preppers, it's a very male pastime, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It certainly seems to be something that men are drawn to. Maybe it, you know, appeases to their masculinity, you know, the idea that they're going to be able to protect their families. A lot of them also just see it as a kind of enhanced man shed. You know, it's a kind of a place where they can hide and their phone doesn't work and they can work on projects in their bunker.
But some psychologists would probably say as well, it's this kind of fantasy of returning to the womb for some men.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, the bunker, I mean, if you think about the bunker as a space that you're reborn from, it is a womb, because if you're not reborn from it, it becomes a tomb.
There's a subway in a bunker somewhere.
There is.
Colorado.
Colorado. Yeah. Oh.
Subway, as in the sandwich shop.
Oh, the sandwich shop. Yeah. I was thinking of a metro train system, okay. There are also metro systems.
You're too long out of America.
Yeah. the Raven Rock bunker in Pennsylvania is essentially an underground city, and it has a Subway sandwich restaurant inside the bunker, which, you know, if you're one of you get that duty as the Subway sandwich worker, yeah, you're going to be the luckiest person in the world in the event of a nuclear war.
This bunker business sounds like the hospitality industry in Ireland at the moment, that you're going to have to do many, many different jobs. There are different reasons around the world. Obviously, nuclear is the one in the 60s, and there's kind of various end of world scenarios and catastrophes they have in there. In Australia, where you went to bunkers there, they obviously are very specific about what they're preparing for.
Yeah, both Australia and California and the Western United States, where I'm from, are obviously, you know, thinking more and more about how to deal with wildfires, and as a result of the climate crisis. And you know, there are two scenarios which align with what preppers had been telling me: you either bug in or you bug out. Now, in California, people often
bug out is obviously to
get out of Dodge. Yeah, you get out of the situation. So in California, that's often what people will do, because they have vehicles, large vehicles that they can load up, and often they have multiple escape routes. In Australia, people have been building fire bunkers.
Yeah.
So you can buy one of these for about $25,000 Australian dollars, and they are airtight. They're sealed, right. So and they have an oxygen supply inside the bunker. So essentially, what you have there in these bushfires are hot, fast burning fires. And the idea is that if, you know, when the fire is getting close and you are not able to evacuate in time, you get into your bunker, you close the hatch, and you wait it out for an hour while the fire burns over you. And some people have put them into use, unfortunately.
Would they have connections to the outside world to find out if the fire is coming to an end or anything when they're down there?
I don't know.
Someone's asking how we listen to radio broadcasts when no one has radios anymore, only smartphones, which will surely go dead.
They'll go dead. And also, getting signal underground is very unlikely. Some people do have ham radios and CB radios that they use.
I want to ask you about Chernobyl, because you finish the book and to go to a place where it looked like the end, it literally looks like the end of the world has already happened with that Chernobyl disaster in 1986.
Yeah, one of the questions that the preppers were never very good at answering was, what happens when you come out of the bunker?
Yes.
What kind of world do you encounter, and what do you do with yourself and your family? What do you go to find? And so someone suggested to me at some point, well, you know, you can go to the post-apocalyptic world. It's Chernobyl. So I went, and I spent 4 days without permission sneaking into the zone, and came within about 3 kilometers of the exploded nuclear reactor number 4, and was able to see the new sarcophagus that they had recently built over it. But what I found there was very interesting. It was the world without us, and it was thriving. There were fruit trees and animals everywhere. We saw moose and elk and wolves. It's sort of, being repopulated because human beings aren't there destroying the environment.
Yeah, where humans aren't there. And we saw little snatches of that, didn't we, in the early days of the pandemic and lockdowns where animals started reclaiming empty streets and they just appeared within a few days of us, of the humans disappearing.
Well, it's a humbling message. You know, if there were to be a terrible calamity that wiped all of us out, the world really wouldn't care.
Yeah, it might be quite happy about things.
Yeah.
Did you in the end kind of look at the preppers and think, why prepare for catastrophe? Well, maybe they could put all their resources and energy into preventing a catastrophe such as climate change, which is still preventable for at least another maybe decade or two.
Yeah, I understand that, but I also, and I did think that, but I also feel like there are so many things that we encounter that are out of our hands, you know, things that feel like we don't have any control over, you know, runaway, unaligned artificial intelligence that might wipe us out, the climate crisis, nuclear war. These aren't necessarily things that we as individuals can avert. And so I did find preppers who were trying to mitigate.
A lot of people would say you could.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, denuclearization looked like it was going to be a policy for a time, and we may have that moment again. So,
well, but these things
are not
necessarily mutually exclusive. We can work on both of those things at the same time.
Exactly. Look, it's fascinating all the same. Bradley Garrett, bunker building for the end time. Someone says, I will take my chances above ground rather than descend into insanity, literally. But someone else says, it's always good to be prepared for any unexpected emergency, which is where you are very much. And
precisely.
But as an academic, you have a connection to UCD, actually, just before you go quickly.
Yeah, I work at the UCD Geography Department.
Great.
Which I have only spent a week in over the past 18 months, but I look forward to getting back to my office.
And Bunker, is it out now? Is it on its way?
It's out now. The paperback is actually coming out in a week.
Ah, very handy in a bunker.
Yeah.
So you don't have to carry a big hardback with you. Bradley Garrett, it's been fascinating.
It's been great. Thank you so much. Best of luck with the book.
Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye. Now we're going to go to Monaghan and Stephen Larmer. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Oliver. How are you?
Very well. You're a butcher.
I'm a butcher. Yes, I am. Yes.
You're creating a fair stir because there's a Kinder Bueno sausage. The Examiner is onto it because of the Cork connection. You better tell us how this is. Tell us what it is, first of all.
Look, sure, we're all a wee bit mad in Monaghan, are we not, Oliver?
Yes. Yeah. We're the Italy of Ireland without the weather.
We're a traditional butcher shop. I'm a third generation butcher. It's a traditional sausage that my grandfather made, my father made and tweaked, and then I come along and I made and tweaked, and it literally is exactly what it says in the tin. It's a traditional pork sausage with Kinder Bueno in it.
Okay.
And it really works.
Where did you get this idea for this abomination?
We've tried lots of combinations. We've tried Stilton and marmalade, chili and chocolate. As I was telling one of your colleagues there.
Sorry, marmalade?
Stilton and marmalade, yeah.
Stilton and marmalade, okay, yeah. And then you put chocolate in it.
We were doing a chili and chocolate as well, so we were.
Oh yeah, that doesn't sound bad, yeah.
Telling one of your colleagues there, we do a hog roast, which is like a pork sausage with a caramelised red onion and apple in it as well.
That's nice. Went down
very well as well.
Yeah.
The chocolate works in the sausage. The hazelnut is pretty inoffensive as well, so just a wee bit of tweaking to get the Bueno into it. And we have done it, like it has worked. Look, there's yay and nay for us, but you're never going to please everybody. But your 98% actually enjoy them and has come back for them.
Are your children responsible for this?
My kids on a Sunday morning would have pancakes every Sunday morning, and one of the little lads would put Nutella and roll a sausage in it. So we were kind of looking at this, so we were and saying, right, this might work. And then myself and two of the other lads there, James and Glenn, we were just talking about what sausage would we make there last week, or the week before actually, for the barbecuing, because people want something a wee bit different there for barbecuing, and it's kind of a talking point as well, you know, that kind of thing.
Yes, certainly
is. And so one of them said, well, right, so will we try this Bueno? As I said to your colleague there a while ago there as well, there was a lot of stuff dumped before we got it right, so it was. but we have it right now, we have it right, and it's working like.
Yes, so you're selling them, people are buying it.
We're selling out nearly every day. Just before I come on there, that's what it was at. I was just making again for today. And so we were like...
It's one of the things people say don't do in life is to see how sausages are made. So, can you explain to us how the Kinder Bueno... are you smashing it up like a kind of McFlurry sausage thing? I don't know how to describe
it. It's the same as I was saying there a while ago to your colleague. How do you get the fig roll into the fig?
Yeah.
Nobody knows that.
Okay, all right, so you're not going to tell us.
And look, it is a pork sausage with Kindle wine. We actually do. We smash it up and put it into it, yeah.
So your wee fella who came up with it, is he actually eating them and going, yeah, this is my creation, and he wants his name probably on it?
No, well, whenever we're making them, are you making Kinder Bueno sausages? That's them there now, is it? He's very keen. Look, sausage gets bad publicity, so they do. Nowadays, everything has to be good going into them, so it is. As I was saying, we're three generations of butchers. It takes a lot to build a reputation, but it takes very little to ruin a reputation, so you have to have it right.
And so the best is from Cork, apparently.
Well, look, that's where we've been buying our pork this last number of years there, so we find it very inconsistent there, so it is. It's been very good. It comes through Duffy's Pork and Bacon or Connolly Meats there. There'll be local suppliers of ours, so they'll be supplying us with the stuff. And Staunton's pork has come out miles ahead of them. I've been quite honest with you, yeah.
You know, I started out kind of thinking this is a terrible idea, but now the more I think of it, when you're talking about it being rolled in a pancake or even just in white bread, because that's quite sweet anyway, it may work. And there's a hazelnutty, because obviously
it's more the hazelnutty flavour you're getting in it, so you're with your chocolate, like, so it is. And like, hazelnut is actually, it's a nice nuts, so it is, like, so it is. And it's pretty inoffensive, so it is. Kinder Bueno is nice, it's just the sweetness, but we've kind of reduced that sweetness a wee bit out of them, so we had quite a wee bit of tweak in there, that they're not just a kind of a real sickly flavour, but yeah. they're not, actually, they're good, and you can really get that hazelnutty flavour to it, so you can't, like...
There's a text in here, because I was wondering where the... because we had Cork, you have Monaghan Butcher, Cork Meat, and the Kinder Bueno... Apparently, it's Kinder belongs to Ferrero here in Piemonte,
yeah,
in mad
right.
Italy. Which realm of madness are you inputting to us here in Italy, says Deirdre, Tortona in Piemonte in Italy. So, yeah.
I'm open to sell the patent.
yeah, exactly. So you can kind of go, it's an Italian delicacy.
Yeah. It really has worked. And look, I would be... quiet enough of myself, wouldn't be into the limelight or whatnot. This last week,
I think it's just gone crazy.
Like, okay. It really has gone crazy. It's kind of beyond belief, being honest with you. And like, we are literally just a humble butchers in Newbliss doing our thing day to day, and it's just really spiral out of control. So what has, like...
And for the uninitiated, that's the very top of Monaghan, because when you look at a map, like if you're watching UTV and you see a little bite out of Northern Ireland, that's North Monaghan, isn't it? So that's just...
Yeah, that's it. That's where we are. Like we're sitting in between, as you know, we're sitting in between Cavan, Coutil, Clonus, Monaghan. Like, we're a village, a small little village here with an Martin's Apple Green filling station. We have three pubs as well, and a butcher. So you kind of, we have no bank, no credit union, so you kind of need to reinvent yourself all the time to keep people coming to you. You know, that kind of way. Like, we
and
do
in fairness, like, they wouldn't come up with a Kinder Bueno, a sausage in Cavan. They just wouldn't have the creativity, to be honest.
Look at that. Okay. That's where I served my time over there many moons ago. So
you've too many customers now. Every slag
for
the girl.
And I got a lot of Cavan customers as well, so we're doing surrounding areas.
Absolutely. Stephen Larmer, and best of luck to all in the Larmer's Butchers, and keep
Thank you.
Kinder Bueno pork sausages with Cork meat and Italian delicacy in it. Good luck to you.
Yeah, and we're giving a good shout out tomorrow and on Sunday as
Absolutely.
Well. Bring the old stuff in.
Mina Khan Abu on Friday and Saturday.
Sorry, yeah, that's it.
Thanks a million. Look after yourself.
Thank you.
51551 is the text. We take a break. Now, the last year, it's obviously forced all of us to take stock of our lives, the direction we're heading in and so on. And we're told the world of work is probably going to change. So is this a good time to study, to retrain, redesign your future? Well, I want to talk to someone who found their way back to education, that they had many obstacles, and maybe they actually found their way back because of them. We'd say good morning to Claire Cullen.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you. What part of the world are you in?
I am in Waterford City, and more specifically, I'm in my car outside my house, hiding from my children.
Oh my God! Okay, right. And the oldest city in the world, in the country, maybe
country.
Not the world, but beautiful, yep. Waterford. Let me start first of all, because we're about education here, and specifically third level. Can you tell us a bit about your first venture into third level after you left school?
Well, my first venture into third level, I went down to UCC in Cork. I grew up in Carrickashore. And I decided I was going to become a dietitian, and I went to study nutritional science, mm-hmm. and I dropped out after about 3 months because I hated it.
Yeah, okay.
So, I decided to go back again a year later and did art, English and politics, and I left after 2 years because I had my first daughter.
Yes.
So that was in my head, that was the end of my educational journey for a little while.
But that's when I moved to Waterford.
I was a full-time mammy for a little while, but I got a part-time job then, mm-hmm. and I was, you know, perfectly happy with my little one at home, my job, and my partner worked, and we were doing grand. But then the recession hit, and all of a sudden I thought, I need to do something to be able to come out the other end of this with better employment prospects. And that's when I went to Waterford Institute of Technology, and I started off doing a three-year ordinary degree in business studies.
Yes.
And I left after 4 years with an honours degree in economics and finance.
Amazing. And you had, as a mature student, what age were you when you went back in?
I was 25.
Which is very young, but obviously in college terms, people think you're ancient, don't they?
The
freshers.
I'll stop. But sure, I thought, in my head, I was 19 still. And then I went into college with a load of actual 19-year-olds and realised, nope, I am not 19.
So,
I think having a child as well meant that I was in a different headspace, a different lifestyle.
Yeah, completely. Sure. Life was happening where it doesn't really to 19-year-olds who are free at last at that stage. How hard was it to go back as a mature student and do the entire course while being a parent?
I suppose looking back, it was incredibly difficult. I do remember nights crying with tiredness. And I remember, you know, trying to fit in everything, you know, childcare, housework. I had a part-time job and a full-time college course. You know, it was all overwhelming. But I suppose once you're in it, you just get on with it.
Yeah. Well, you must have been very tenacious and tough.
Well, I had a lot of support as well from my lecturers and even my colleagues in the class who felt desperately sorry for this poor old one.
You were worn out.
I was worn out, but it was great. It was a real boost for the confidence. You know, having dropped out of college twice, having had an unplanned pregnancy young, you know, I was trying to prove myself as well.
Yeah, and you did. And you should congratulate yourself for that. Yeah, you did. Because you didn't stop there. You went straight to work, really, didn't you? After your honours degree.
Yeah, I did. I went into the company that I had done my work experience with during the degree, hired me straight away afterwards. So I was, at this point, I was a bit older. I was 28, married, and I was pregnant with my second child and delighted with myself going into work. Like, life had worked out for me. I had ticked all the boxes. I was delighted with myself.
And what happened?
Well, unfortunately, my third baby was stillborn. I lost her at 26 weeks. And I think everything just ended for me then. That part of my life, that trajectory that I was on, just came kind of crashing down. And I found it very hard to return to normal. There was no going back, really, for me. It was about making a whole new life for myself now with this new reality that I was facing. I was looking for a community of people who could support me. So I joined a pregnancy loss support charity and I made loads of friends there. And I had to reassess my priorities and a career in finance with my newfound vulnerability and new focus on my family meant that they really weren't compatible. The type of career that I had been pursuing before just wasn't going to work for me. So I started working here in Waterford in a not-for-profit, not using my degree, not using any of the skills that I built up, but in a lovely kind of caring environment where I was able to sort of recover and heal and also pursue this sort of advocacy and charity work as well.
I'm going to come to that in a minute, but I just want to kind of portray the picture for people of what you put together. You did amazing achievements later, but you had, as you say, everything sorted in life. You had gone back into education against the odds. You'd come out, you had the job in finance, and this was obviously a terrible, terrible blow. But I'm trying to get, how long did it take before you know, what was that period like in your life, and how long was it when you realised you had to give up your career? Because you're in grief, aren't you?
Well, that was it. I had lost the baby and I was on maternity leave. And it's a quite unique and horrible situation to be on maternity leave with no baby.
Yeah.
And I was trying to kind of gather myself to get to the point where I could go back to work. And I started doing things like doing a dry run of the drive back to work. You know, driving back up the road, it was a bit of a commute. It was a 50-kilometre commute. And I never made it. I never actually made it to the office. I was to go back and collect bits and pieces that I had left there. And I could never even make it the whole way to the office. I never made it there. So I knew that things had to change. I couldn't face that. I tried counselling. I'd been to support groups. But there was just no going back.
One of the difficulties you faced in terms of the office was people were of an age where there were a lot of pregnancies, weren't there?
loads of pregnancies. I think I was one of three pregnant women on my team, and one was due the same week as I had been.
Yeah, gosh. It was very tough. It's amazing, really, that you came through it at all, to be honest. But you had two young kids at home anyway, so...
Well, exactly. I had great support from my family. I had my kids, you know, and I had the support of the people that I'd met through the charity. And I had seen other people recover, which I think was the main thing. I'd seen other people come back to themselves, come back to their lives, changed forever, but certainly not less than.
Yeah. But aside from the family, I mean, just for your own personal, you know, achievements, you'd studied hard for that job and you had to leave it for your own mental health, really, didn't you?
Yes, exactly. You know, you have to prioritise your well-being at some point, particularly when other people rely on you, but even just for yourself. Sometimes you just have to accept that something is no longer for you after a change.
Something that really motivated you again was the Repeal the 8th referendum. Can you take us back to your involvement there?
Absolutely. My daughter's stillbirth was at the end of 6 weeks of knowing that she was dying. In 2015, when there was no other option but to carry the pregnancy or travel. And as I said, I had two other kids that I wasn't prepared to leave to travel to the UK to lose my baby there and then come home without her. So I took the option of waiting for her to pass away and deliver her here in Waterford. I had a great care team in the hospital here in Waterford. Yeah. But that period of waiting for her to die so that I could deliver a dead baby was unbelievably traumatic. I think that was really the what did for me in terms of not being able to go back to my life again and not be able to recover as well as I thought I could. And I was just determined that this was not going to be inflicted on other women after that, that we would have a choice, just an option. You know, you get to pick what's best for you. Yeah. So I worked with the charity and an advocacy group called Terminations for Medical Reasons Ireland, and we worked very hard and advocated for our members so that we could, first of all, get the referendum and then so that we could win it and be able to have the option of choice in Ireland for women who are pregnant.
And it worked, and it was a big part of that campaign, I remember, 2018. So that's what you were doing with your young family, and you did a great thing for other women there.
Thank you. I hope so. I hope we see a difference in sort of pregnancy outcomes and mental health outcomes when pregnancy goes wrong as a result of having better choices now.
What's extraordinary is that when you were campaigning that referendum, you were also pregnant.
I was. I had a full-time job. I was pregnant on my fourth gorgeous girl and campaigning as well. And all of this, of course, came to a head at the same time. The referendum was on the 25th of May, and exactly 2 weeks later, I gave birth to my daughter. Stressful time.
Yeah. But you were inspired again and thinking about going back to college.
Well, that's right. After that, I was on maternity leave, and I think that was really the first time I gave myself time to properly process everything that had happened in the previous 3 years. So I was really grieving for the first time without the campaigning elements. I was able to remember, you know, some of the happy times of being pregnant with Alex, who we lost. And I was really considering, you know, where I wanted to go with my own life, and decided to take some time out, that not to return to my job, because as wonderful as it was very full on. And I really wanted to be able to focus on the three kids and be able to find something that was more flexible and that I would be able to work around my family. Yeah. They became my priority, or they had always been my number one priority, but I always saw my career as sort of for them, whereas now I was much more valuing the time that I spent with them and doing a little bit less with that required money.
Brilliant.
More baking.
And you went and you studied Tangent. It was a course in Trinity College, wasn't it? Again, in business. And tell us what came out of that. You have a business now, don't you, that you run with someone that you met in Trinity?
No, actually, a friend of mine, Jennifer Ryan, who I'd met through the Pregnancy Loss Charity.
Right.
She and I have been chatting about different ideas that we had, and we had this idea for a pregnancy loss support journal, something that would be a self-help tool for people who were experiencing what we had, which was sort of the anticipation of losing a baby and then the loss and the grieving and the recovering. And I lost my job, my part-time lovely job, during the pandemic last year, and I was looking for something to upscale and rescale in, and that's when I came across these fabulous Springboard-funded courses in Tangent at Trinity College.
Yeah.
So they were funded. They didn't cost me anything.
Right, right.
Which is huge for us, obviously, because accessibility was the issue and cost was the issue for any return to education. I've always wanted to do postgraduate study, but it's just prohibitively expensive.
Yeah.
So the fact that these were funded and I was available to online last year and I was able to attend from my bedroom in Waterford going to Trinity, and I found the lecturers just really, really helpful. The fact that the staff was so approachable and friendly and they gave me so much support that during the course, I used this idea of the pregnancy loss journal as one of the basis for my project. So I was doing like interviews with people who had lost babies and saying, would this help? And would this be something that would help you in this case? And realised that there was a huge amount of support that was missing. And not in terms of like mental health support, but really like communities needed support to help each other through pregnancy loss.
Yeah.
You know, that there was a lack of understanding around pregnancy loss in workplaces, in friend groups, in families. And that that was what was kind of holding people back from recovering as well as they could from pregnancy loss, from healing and moving on from pregnancy loss.
Yeah.
And I rang my friend and I said, you know, there's a business in this. And she and I both said, well, look, it would be unethical to make money from something like
this.
Yeah,
but Viloma is the card company. Jennifer
Viloma
Ryan
is the pregnancy
Viloma,
loss
V-I-L-O-M-A-H. And a gorgeous idea, gorgeous cards in there. Sorry, we're running just out of time, I'm afraid, Claire.
Oh,
but
sorry.
You study with Tangent at Trinity College, but there's great courses all over the country for people who want to see what's out there. Springboardcourses.ie is a good place to start. And we're getting lots of messages already from people who are lauding going back into education as a mature student. So you're a great advertisement and I wish you well and congratulations on what you've done after all you've been through. So,
oh well,
it's time to go back into the kids that you've been hiding from down in Waterford.
No, I'm enjoying my coffee and car.
The work
well,
never ends.
If anybody's considering it, they should check out the Tangent website. I know they have an open day on the 9th of August.
Great.
And they should have a look at the Tangent website.
The 9th of August.
And check out the Viloma.ie website.
Brilliant. Viloma.ie. Thanks a million, Claire Cullen. Good morning.
Thank you.